Welcoming into the program our friend Colin Fleming, whose newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is an unbelievably good and powerful book that, as I've said, will change your life and is available right now wherever fine books are sold. Colin Fleming, welcome in, sir.
Hey, thanks for that, buddy.
Of course, doing what we do here, a lot going on, and, well, a lot to cover this afternoon, but I need to get my weekly check-in on your Zulu warrior-ness. How did today go?
Oh, nothing today.
Oh, no.
I woke up with a migraine. I haven't run the stairs since last Monday. I walked 10 miles over the weekend, and I've reached the point where that causes me great shame, so I probably should start working on that and have a better mindset about 10 miles, because it's not horrible, but I've been pretty useless the first 2 days of this official work week.
Well, I'm going to say you've earned it, so I'm not judging you. I just want you to know that. Not that you care, but that's where I come down on this.
I go at a pace to blister the sun, my friend, so sometimes I have to push back a little bit, but I'd gone like 2 weeks without climbing the stairs before I did all those days in a row, so it comes in spurts. The problem is that you have to walk 10 miles to get to the stairs, right?
Right.
That's less than ideal than when I could walk or run the 3 miles over to Charlestown, so it's like quite a Lewis and Clark type of haul just to get to that. It shows you how rare 100 consecutive stairs outside are.
Well, exactly. Well, we want to cover a lot of different subjects today. Where to begin? Let's start with a tale from Matthew Gregory Lewis that includes, well, let's see, bandits, ghosts, gothic romance, and the devil.
Yes. You're kind to indulge me. I was thinking about this while I was sitting at the harbor a little while ago. You're kind to indulge me when I come along and say, why don't we talk about these? Because you must think on some level, like, oh, man, I have to prep for this. Boom. Then maybe you also think, he'll just talk about it or whatever. It'll be cool. But yes, it's a lot. So we have the less than 20-year-old Mr. Lewis who pens The Monk. And The Monk is, well, there's really no sense in trying to sum up the plot, is there?
No.
It's like you can't, I would give everyone their own migraine if I attempted to do that. But the parts you mentioned are in some ways the least sensationalistic aspects of this plot. One of the themes, for instance, of this novel is not just sort of horny nuns who get pregnant, but a demon who seduces people, and there's a serpent, and when the demon seduces this one guy, this monk who's sort of the star monk, but he's had a fall from monkly grace, from aesthetic grace, and he's been bitten by a serpent, and he's dying, and she tries to suck the poison out of his womb, and she's dying, but she's really just sort of like faking, and she's like, I'm expiring, quick, hump me before I go, and he's like, oh no, I'm on my way out too, but I will do this humping right now, we'll make that happen. It's like, oh, just kidding. And then there's this whole, like, I guess you'd have to call it, and I'm trying to be respectful, you'd have to call it a whole rape subplot, and there is a lot happening in this book, which did not go over well with reviewers in some ways. Now, it's a gothic, obviously, but it's one of those gothics that gets the appellation male gothic. Like, let's put this on, only a guy could be this foul and twisted and sick, and that was kind of the rub with the reviews that went along the lines of this person, and he was monk, or Lewis was anonymous at first when he wrote this, and he published this rather, and they said that he's this profligate individual who is inflicting that profligacy on the world, and yet everyone who ripped this book for how bad and evil and wicked it was had to say, the prose is pretty much matchless. This guy writes circles around other people, and it made me think of, you see the email chain, you see Norberg's name at the top. He was a professor I had in college at BC, and you had to do these one-page papers when you went in for class. That was his big assignment thing. And he just gave everyone this de facto check, which meant essentially that you did the assignment. One time, though, he gave me a check plus, because he liked what I had done, plus check minus, which he thought was very clever. So the reviews for this particular book were very check plus slash check minus.
Yeah, we didn't like the incest or the cross-dressing, but man, it was well-written.
Yeah, and well, what people really objected to more was that Lewis had a go at, it was only in one paragraph. He wrote a kind of apologia for it later, but he had a go at the Bible because I guess it was inevitable. And he signed it as he represented himself as a lawmaker. So Samuel Coleridge is reviewing the book, and he stops at the end and says, this was written by one of the people who makes the laws of our land, because Lewis was just simply lying. He's like, and what Coleridge essentially says is, shudder, deal with that. How's that for troubling? This doesn't augur well for us going forward. And at the end, you think this couldn't get any wackier with everything that happens. The monk of the title is in jail, and Satan comes over and says, look, I will spring you from this jail. You just have to give me your soul. And he thinks about this for a while, and there's this loophole that Satan builds in, like a codicil that he builds into this agreement. The guy's out of jail. He's in the woods. He's like, well, okay, I'm going to really suck in the hereafter, but at least for now I can live. And Satan's like, no, you didn't read that clause. Picks him up, lifts him high into the air, and drops him not to his death, but 6 days of suffering blood-vomiting death. It's like the end.
Happy ending right there. That's the monk from Matthew Gregory Lewis. Let's move to, you talk about me indulging you. No, it's actually a chance for me sometimes to revisit wonderful experiences from the past, but sometimes to wrap myself in something brand new. And I have to say, I knew nothing about the Talus Scholars and this work that has gone on for, more than three decades now.
The Josquin Masses. And he was the Elvis, really, of his day in the early 16th century. And masses were the thing that you wanted to rock out to, really. And it was as big as this guy was a celebrity composer. And the Talus Scholars have put out their ninth and concluding volume of the complete masses of Josquin. And a number of his masses and other works over the years have been misattributed to him, and they've sort of fallen back to other composers or whatnot. But this is radical, and it sounds like somebody may be listening like, oh, how exciting can that be? It must be pretty boring listening to these, not just masses at any time, the music of the mass, but masses from that long ago. And they are really revolutionary works, and it's just singing. There's no instrumental accompaniment or anything like that. But what happened at the time, what was so radical about Josquin, is that he essentially invented this idea of the paraphrase mass and the parody mass. And the way those would work was something like the paraphrase mass. You would take a secular song, and you'd take a fragment of it, and you'd interpolate that into the musical service of the church, and a very popular secular song. So it'd be taking, I don't know, who do the kids listen to right now? I'm not saying they would be like that wet-ass, et cetera, type song, but something along those lines. Or you'd have a parody mass, and what you do is you are taking a motet, but you're taking not the entire vocal polyphony of the motet, you're taking maybe just a strand. So you're really doing this, it's a musical synthetic cubism, in essence, where you're taking what's from outside the church, you're bringing it into the church, and you'd already had before this notion of it's called the mensuration canon. It's a fancy way of saying a very evolved kind of singing. And we think of we're all in third grade, right? And he's singing the round, and I start singing, this is my land, and then you and Carrie start. But what happened with the mensuration canon, and this was just one of Josquin's big sort of power moves, was that he would speed up the different lines of the musical composition. So I'd start by singing This Land Is My Land, and then you and Carrie would begin, race up from behind me, speed out in front of me, and then maybe I'd lap you, that kind of thing. So you had a lot going on prismatically at once with the secular and the sacred coming together. And again, it's radical. And for people out there who think, it's going to be really boring, listen to it. This is some of the most impressive composing that you'll ever hear in your life. You can understand what Bach was thinking. He must have heard a lot of this and thought, oh, yes, I'll do my fugue stuff.
Yeah, very powerful. And again, I knew nothing about it. So thanks for exposing me to that. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to the celebration of a couple of 50th anniversaries, starting with Hammer Films' The Vampire Lovers.
Came out in 1970, and this is kicking off a trilogy of Well, really, lesbian vampire films. Now, the idea of the sapphic is quite common, actually, throughout vampire lore and history. And this film is based, put giant quotation marks around that, on Sheridan Le Fanu's Camilla, which was this famous Irish vampire story. And it has a very sexy Ingrid Pitt in this. And I think it would have been, well, I think it's shocking at really any time in some of the ways that this functions. And I know a guy like you enjoys the occasional trip to the Isle of Lesbos.
Well, especially when you have a poster that says, "If you dare taste the bloody passion of the deadly passion of the blood nymphs." How do you not watch that?
And I think some of the overt symbolism of that and the menses and everything, and there's a lot, as they say, to unpack.
Oh, yes.
But I think it speaks to not taking any downtime, no matter the time of the month, as it were. So you have this, it makes sense. And that's part of the thing, to be serious about. That's sort of like one of the angles of all of vampire lore and literature, the drinking of, it's not being gross, is what it is, the drinking of various sorts of bodily fluids, whether even blood, and certainly you have that in the church, right? You have that with the whole communion in the body and blood of Christ, and you have this lot of seminal imagery with Stoker's novel, and you have a lot of kind of menses imagery with this particular undertaking, but it's a well-made film. Now, the next two films in this trilogy, you don't really want to dabble too much in Hammer horror after, like, 1970. There's a quick drop-off in quality. A good tip-off that this is going to be pretty good is that you have you can look at the cast, right? You have Peter Cushing, and that's going to tell you that he's not just going to be mailing it in. And it was a sort of sexy breakout role for Ingrid Pitt, and the way this works, she basically goes around with her mother and ends up getting adopted by people, and she goes into the house and she befriends the young buxom lady of the house and does things to her breasts and kills her, and then she has to be dispatched with herself. But I always like these, and I think it's not just the 50th anniversary that made me bring this up, but it's perfect for November. It's just, it always looks like it's November in a Hammer horror film, and you're off somewhere in, like, I don't know, Europe and Bavaria. You never exactly really know with some of these things. And the leaves are always, I can just imagine the stage manager, "Get me more bags of leaves," right? You always have the leaves going around and around.
Yeah.
And it just fits really well with this particular time.
I enjoyed reading about Ingrid Pitt kept losing her fangs. They would fall out of her mouth and land on, Kate O'Mara's cleavage, and eventually she borrowed someone's chewing gum to secure the fangs in her mouth.
Before the credits even come up, like, there's this guy. There's always some guy whose, like, sister has been killed or something like that, or his beloved in an earlier film, and he is going to get rid of the vampire who did this, and the vampire comes over, and the female vampire, and she's hot. She's like, "Oh, I'm going to kiss you." He thinks, okay, maybe I can convert her away from this vampire thing. We can do some, like, kissing. We'll see how that goes. And there's a cut-in of the top of her breast going into the cross dangling around his neck. Like, you really have to get the camera in there to have that sort of image. Just, like, it must have practically been touching. Like, just keep cranking it over there. And it's like, oh, it's going to be one of those films. Like, right away, the credits come up. It's like, okay, I think I'll stay.
Yes, we know where we are, right. And from there to another 50-year-old work of art, Led Zeppelin III.
Led Zeppelin III must have, not so much the first song, Immigrant Song, but when you get to the second song, Friends, would have, I think, shocked people who had an inkling of what they were getting from Led Zeppelin at the time. It's the big departure. So this is the album. Transitional albums interest me because they're often cited when they come out as being heavily flawed. Like you have with the Beatles, for instance, Help is a transition album. It's sort of rooted in that Beatlemania of A Hard Day's Night, partially. And then you have the introspection of Beatles for Sale, and you're looking towards kind of the English folk of Rubber Soul. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge of a record. And this Zeppelin album is a bit of a hodgepodge, too. But it's enlivened by the range of instruments that these guys could play. And I'm not the staunchest Led Zeppelin supporter, as you know, but I always have found this album to be amongst their most interesting, maybe like their last truly interesting album, where you didn't have an idea what was going to come. Parts of Led Zeppelin, that's not really Led Zeppelin 4, but we all call it that, parts of Led Zeppelin 4 just sound like afterthoughts from Led Zeppelin 3, when there was a lot of sort of daring do. And I've never been a huge fan of John Bonham, the drummer, but this is an album really for him to shine, when you have something like that shuffle he plays on Gallows Pole. He was always good at shuffles. And then his own song, Out on the Tiles, he locks into that groove, which is just like the Bonham kind of groove. In fact, you'll see the Stone Roses around the Second Coming era start to sort of revisit their version with their drummer Rennie of that Bonham groove on a B-side like Breakout. Not a lot of people know it. You can hear it on YouTube, but it's like a slowed down version of the Bonham groove.
Well, and you don't expect on a Zeppelin album to hear things like steel guitar, mandolin, banjo.
No, you expect like some of that stuff, maybe not banjo, but you expect some of that on like an English folk album from the late 60s. That's not like Nick Drake, but like some of his island label mates would have records along those lines, right? Or like a Richard Thompson type of album. So, no, you're not really expecting that with Zeppelin. And you listen to like the last cut of the album, it doesn't even have drums. So there's a lot of that kind of far-ranging finesse to that. And they pull that off because they always had this sort of mystic, out-of-time J.R. Tolkien sort of vibe. And this plays well to that strength without really being as on the nose as some of the like Battle of Evermore. Battle of Evermore is kind of twee. It's kind of pretentious. And you don't really have pretentious here. You have this idea of this like rustic Aran Island sort of shed and peat all around, and musicians within that shed/house making music together.
And finally, we want to talk about a terrific radio program and one of its best episodes. And this is the Good Ghost episode of the series Quiet Please, which I'm surprised only aired for a couple of years.
I've been thinking a lot about this series lately. I go through these different periods where I pass out at night to maybe it's Newhart, maybe it's the Golden Girls, maybe it's bad Hallmark Christmas movies. I've been doing it a lot lately too, radio programs. And I have a pretty steeped background in all of these radio programs and radio history. And I'm going to say that Quiet Please is the absolute best of them. And I think that its actor, Ernest Chappell, and there are other people who are actors too, I think he's one of the best American actors of all time. And this episode shows that. So the setup was essentially that you have Willis Cooper, and he had created Lights Out, moves on to this other show, and it's going to be Ernest Chappell talking to you. He's actually billed at the end by Cooper as the man who talked to you, which I think is just a great summation, right? Isn't that like a wonderful thing? Because it's that Orson Welles notion of first person singular. So it actually has a lot in common with that early Mercury Theater kind of idea. And so Chappell, he had never acted before. He had been an announcer for the Campbell Soup, so he had some affiliation with Welles. This guy, he inhabits a different character in every single episode, and you wouldn't think it's the same guy. It blows my mind that he has no acting background. Like, I'm flummoxed by that. So in this episode, he plays a guy in Chicago who's out downtown, and his friend shoots him, and he's dead. And he gets up, and he doesn't realize he's a ghost right away, and he tries to get on the subway. And there are certain rules to his version of being dead. You can't go up the subway stairs. You can't go down the subway stairs. So he hasn't figured out yet how to get around, but this person who murdered him did so to get his girl, as it were. And he wants the woman to be happy. That's the twist. That's the through line. That's the driver. And so he's going to attempt to work with the guy who killed him. It's just a wonderful premise, don't you think?
Oh, it's wonderful. One of the things I like about Quiet Please is they understood the power of silence. And there are times when you think, what's happening? But when you're on edge already, that silence just helps build the tension.
Silence is a huge part of writing. And the way that, for instance, you come to the end of a paragraph and another paragraph is going to begin, and there's whatever that white liminal space is. You can make so much happen within that white space. You can have life completely change for characters within that stoppage of one paragraph and the beginning of the next. And Willis Cooper is, for radio, this is amazing radio writing. Like, you could put some of this down on the page and it reads rather well. And then you give it to Ernest Chappell. These inflections of the voice he uses, too, along that level of detail that you're speaking about, the way he'll pronounce certain words. And sometimes when you'll see, like, misapplied grammar, like wrong grammar, it becomes rather heavy-handed and it doesn't work. They nail the voice every time. And in this episode, so it's a guy who has, like, double negatives, that type of thing, but not a double negative every single time, which is even how people who use double negatives, they don't always use that double negative. Even like the Cretans of the North End don't do that every time. And so you have Chappell with that such a believable voice. And then you have a twist within a twist within a twist as this story goes along. And you're so invested in these people, even the bad guys. So like when the good ghost turns up at his murderer's place, it's just, I love this detail. He wakes them up. And the guy is, of course, he's terrified, and he says, okay, move over, I need to think. And he sits on the bed, and the guy is just sitting next to him, chattering, terrified. The ghost is tired, he takes a nap. It's two guys sleeping in the bed together. It's just, it's so surprisingly written. You would never expect, like, that kind of detail, that scene, that it's going to lodge in your mind now, and it's just bravura radio.
Yeah, if you haven't listened before, most of the episodes are in the public domain, so you can get them online, and they're well worth the time. Quiet, Please, but especially check out this one featuring Ernest Chappell, as always. Good Ghost, He Is Quietly Yours, Colin Fleming. Colin, thank you so much for joining us again. Get online, go wherever you go to buy your books, and get a copy of Meathead's Say the Realest Things. You will love it. And Colin, we will talk with you next week.
Okay, sounds good, my friend.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.